How many of you ladies here tonight know that you could be happy if only everything went your way? How many of you know that? That you could be happy if everything went your way? I've always thought that if only I could get my circumstances into the kind of way that I wanted them to go, that I could be happy. And as I started out very young in life, I began to think that if only I could get things turned around to fit my image of what I thought I could become, I could be happy. And I started making plans for myself at a very early age. Now, I don't know how many of you are really goal setters and get everything organized and planned way ahead. But as I started out, I thought, if I don't get my life pulled together, and if I don't give myself some goals, I'm not going to get very far at all. Now, I grew up in the Depression times, and there aren't, I don't think, very many of you here that remember the Depression. Maybe a few now and then. Maybe you've at least read about it. And in those days, we didn't have much money. And so each one of us had to figure out how we were going to pull ourselves up and become something. The great American dream that if only we did the right things, went to the right places, joined the right clubs, learned the right things, went to the right church, that someday, in some way, we're going to amount to something. So I started out very early planning how I was going to do this. And tomorrow, as we work together on the different temperaments and types of personalities, we'll see that there are certain kinds of women, and men also, but we're talking here this weekend about women, who actually want to get charge of everything and take control and get on with life. Now, I was that kind of a person. I wanted to get hold of it. I wanted to take charge of it. And I was going to make myself into something wonderful. I knew that within me somewhere beat the heart of a queen. And I figured that it was just waiting to get out, waiting for the right kind of circumstances where I could become and do the kind of things that I wanted to be. Now, unfortunately, I lived in three rooms behind my father's store in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And when you live in three rooms behind a store, there's only one way to go, and that's up. And so I began to look around and try to figure out how I was going to get me out of there and make me into what I wanted to be. Now, I don't know, is there anyone here that's ever been to Haverhill? I found one lady this morning that had been to Haverhill. Were you the same one? No, either. You weren't there this morning. Did you live in Haverhill or just pass through it?
Boston.
Well, that's big time. I'm talking about Haverhill. And you didn't live then in Haverhill, just pass through, which is the best thing to do with Haverhill, is to pass right through it. But I unfortunately lived there, and so as I lived in Haverhill, especially in the three rooms behind the store, I looked around trying to figure out what I could do to make me better. Now, in those days, they told us that education was the panacea for all the ills of the country, and that if only we could become educated, we were going to turn out all right. So we all studied very hard so we could become wonderful. And we all did. You see, everybody here today can read and write, correct? And you see, the world is in worse shape than it was when I was a child. So that wasn't the answer, but I thought it was. And so I listened to what they told us, and I decided that's what I had better do. I had better get smart. Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to get smart was the fact that I didn't have much going for me in the area of looks. And I had this little brother that was very cute, and he had curly hair and big blue eyes, long curly eyelashes, dimples. He was just put together so well. And everywhere my mother would take the two of us, we would walk along, and people would look down at him and they'd say, "Isn't he adorable?" And then there'd be this look at me. And they'd look me up and down and try to assess me and come up with something complimentary. And as the silence went on, they would finally look at my mother and they'd say, "Well, she must be smart." Now, I figured the best thing that could be said about me was that I must be smart. I had better get smart. So I worked very hard to study, and I wanted to be as smart as I could possibly be, and I figured if you don't have anything else going for you, at least be smart. So I worked hard, studied, worked, read, all the different things I could do to make myself wonderful. And as I worked at this kind of thing, I used to read especially those types of novels that took place on southern plantations. Now, I love that feeling, and I thought, now that is for me. If only I could get myself into one of those houses up on top of those hills down in Georgia. And I pictured myself being up there, all of those houses. If you recall, in fact, how many of you have read this kind of thing? I mean, besides me. Oh, one, a bunch of dreamers. That's great. I used to think that if I could get into one of these houses, and all of them were big white houses on top of hills. I mean, they didn't have little grubby houses down in valleys. They were all big houses up on top of hills, and they all had columns out in front, big white columns out in front. And I thought, now that's for me, a house like that with those big columns out in front. I knew I could be happy in that kind of a situation. And inside of these houses, they all had sweeping circular staircases. And every evening, the heroine would come down in her ball gown with the crinoline skirts, and she'd come sweeping down the staircase, and underneath there'd be a 40-piece orchestra secreted under the stairs. And they'd be playing away beautiful romantic music as she waltzed off to the ball, into the carriage, and off she went with Prince Charming. And I thought, that's for me. That's what I wanted to do. I figured if I could only come down one of those staircases with the orchestra and the crinoline skirts and the whole thing, I knew that I could be happy. Now, on the few winter evenings when the heroine did not go to the ball, she would sit upstairs in her bedroom. And every one of those bedrooms always had a fireplace. And she would sit there beside the fireplace in her wing chair reading love poetry. I thought, that is for me. If I could only sit there in a wing chair and read love poetry, I knew I could be happy. Now, the only problem with this wishful kind of reading is that when you do close the book, where are you? You're still sitting in three rooms behind your father's store in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And the only column that we had out front was the rotating barber pole for the shop next door. The only staircase we had was a ladder that dropped through a trap door into the oil tank room where I personally pumped kerosene by the gallon for the customers. And the only fireplace we had was a little gas grate in the bedroom where all five of us slept in layers. Now, this was hardly that elegant plantation living that I longed for. And so as I would look around there, I would say to myself, Florence, somehow, you've got to get yourself out of here. You've got to get yourself into something different. You've got to make yourself into what you know you could be. So I started out really working, setting the goals and deciding where I was going to go. All through high school, I didn't go to any of the proms, the dances, or any of the exciting things that went on. I just stayed home and studied. Now, this was not totally a thirst for knowledge. It was partly the fact that no one ever asked me out. Now, I don't know how you looked in high school, but my daughters now look at my high school pictures, and they say, Mother, I can see why nobody ever asked you out. By the time I finished high school, I had at least become smart. I had gotten on the high honor roll, had a scholarship to the state university, had joined all the right clubs and done the right things so that I was ready to go on and get myself educated. That was my first goal. I must get educated. So off I went to the University of Massachusetts, the big time in Amherst, and I thought that once I got there that I was going to be a new person. I felt that a ride across the state of Massachusetts on a Greyhound bus would transform me into something new. And for those of you that haven't tried that, it doesn't work at all. I got off the same little dull girl I was when I got on, carrying all of my possessions in two shopping bags with the little rope handles. That was everything I owned right there. And I got off the Greyhound bus and entered the University of Massachusetts, the big time, and I knew that I was going to become something new and wonderful. Now, I was able to follow my studies as I was supposed to do. I worked very hard at that, but since I had studied so hard in high school, it was not difficult for me. I got A's in almost everything I took, and I ended up with four majors. I had a full major in English, a full major in speech, a full major in education, and a minor in psychology. Now, it takes a little time to do that. And so I worked very hard to get all those things done so that I could become what I needed to be, an educated person to go out into the world and change it. Now, as I went through college, I did realize, as I joined a sorority, that while I was able to handle the academic things, I really was woefully inept in the area of the social graces. We had not needed to know a lot to eat out in the store in front of the customers. And consequently, I didn't know anything about arranging a centerpiece. My mother put the milk bottle in the center of the table. In fact, her idea of a fancy meal was when she took the milk bottle off the table and put it under the table. So we also never had needed to know how to put a candelabra or anything of that, because certainly we didn't need that in the store. And so when I got into the sorority, it was really a job for me to learn how to become a gracious lady. And yet I knew that I had to do that, because what good would it be to be so intelligent if you didn't also know how to do the social graces, without which one cannot become a social success in life. So I worked at this in order that I could learn these things. I took books out of the library on etiquette. I watched what the house mother did. I became the house chairman, put on all of the parties. One of the parties that I did that was the most successful was my senior year, when I was the rush chairman, and I put on a rush party where we decided in February in Massachusetts to make the whole living room into a beach. And so we got boyfriends to go to the Cape and bring back big dump trucks full of white beach sand. And we laid newspapers on the carpeting and had them put the chute right in the living room window and emptied all the trucks full of sand right in there. And they made mounds of things. And we wore bathing suits and had little pails and shovels. And we sat around on the sand in February on the carpeting at Kappa Alpha Theta. Now, the only thing that I had neglected to plan in this great party that I had put together, the only thing I had neglected was how one would get the sand out afterwards. When I went back from my fifth reunion, the Thetas were still crunching over the carpet. But I thought this was a great success. I had watched how people had done things. I had learned how to do it. I had become in charge. Anything I attempted in life, I always wanted to be in charge of it. I never liked to join any clubs that I can't see that I can be president within 6 months. Because, after all, What fun would it be to just sit around with these inefficient women unless one could run it and shake them all up. So I always wanted to run everything. So consequently, in fact, since you seem to respond to that, you must all be leaders, and I will mention it one time that I did become president of the Connecticut Speech and Drama Association on the first meeting before I joined. I thought that was one of my best. And so I had always wanted to run everything that I possibly could. So as I was going through college, I worked at all the things that would make me into the kind of person that I knew I was designed to be. I was taking control of my life in the best way I know how to do it. So by the time I had graduated from college, I felt myself that I was totally educated and that I was a gracious lady. Now, I don't know how many of you thought you were brilliant at 21, but it is not necessarily a long-lived delusion. But as I got out of college thinking that I knew everything, I went back to Haverhill to teach. Now, since you know what Haverhill is, you know that if anyone of any intelligence ever got out of there, they would be certainly foolish to go back. However, I had spent so much time during college making myself wonderful that I felt it would be a shame not to let the home folks see the improvements. So I went back to Haverhill, and I began teaching in the same high school where I had been 4 years before. Now, I was very excited because I then earned, at that time, $1,800 a year. And that was a pretty big money for Haverhill in those days. And so, and this was in 1949, and for those of you who want to figure out my age, I did once skip a grade, so you can delete one from your total. So as I settled into Haverhill High School, I now had all of this money, $1,800 a year, totally educated, a gracious lady, and now I had all this money. That was my third goal, was to have money. And so I wanted that. So I took all my money, and I set after my fourth goal, which was to become well-dressed. Now, for those few of you who lived in the Depression years, you know that we did not have much in the way of clothes. In fact, my mother felt that since we had so few clothes, they should all be so drab and nondescript that no one would realize we were wearing the same thing all the time. So consequently, everything I had was so dull that you could place me up against the wall in any given room and I'd blend it in with the wallpaper. So when I went out, having spent what one might call a beige childhood, so when I grew up and had all of this money, I went into Filene's Basement in Boston. Now, surely this lady from Boston can attest to the fact that there is a place called Filene's Basement, and some others know over here? Somebody over here been there, too? Oh, all of you back there. That's why you look so elegant, yes. Because this lady over here has been to both Haverhill and Boston, which makes her a step above you. But as I went into Filene's, it's this place, huge store, three basement levels. Everything is thrown on tables or pipe racks. You fight over it. That's part of the spirit of the thing. And they have large tags on everything, and it gets marked down 25% every 7 days. So what you try to do is you try to watch it as it gets marked down, and you try to buy it just the day before they give it away to the Salvation Army. And if you can do that properly, as I did, at the end of 1 year, I was able to have in my hands, paid for, 40 suits, 35 dresses, and about 30 pairs of shoes. And I did at that point proclaim myself to be the best-dressed woman in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Now, unfortunately, there's somebody that's been there, and so you know that's not quite such a trick as it might sound. But I was so happy with myself at this point that I was now totally educated, a gracious lady, had all this money for this job, and I now was the best-dressed woman in Haverhill. My students began to keep a book on how many days I could go in a row without ever wearing the same thing twice. And so I was so thrilled that people were noticing my clothes, that I was becoming something. Now, there's when you have all of this going for you, there's still a few things you want in life to be totally happy, and one was I really wanted some recognition in the community, because I thought, what good does it really do you if you're so intelligent and you're so charming and gracious and you have all this this money and you have this fine position in the community if people don't really know who you are? And so I began then to join things and to get into important things where people would take your picture. And in those days, they used to follow people, and they used to take picture society. Whoever was pouring tea that week had their picture in the paper. They've cut that out now. Women's Lib doesn't like pouring tea. But we used to do a lot of that at that time. And so as I would go to these various club meetings, I had an affinity for the camera. And I learned to stand where the photographer was. And if you watch out for this, you usually can end up right in the center. And what the best thing is to do, if you plan this correctly, I used to try to always be sure that you wear something that is dark, not big, loud prints, and something that's dark and simple and preferably a little white at the neck. And this will make you photograph much better than anything else. And so then to make sure that you look the best and don't look overweight in any way, you stand sideways like this. And if you can get in the right position along this line, it'll take 10 pounds off you immediately. And then to make sure that you really photograph well is you try to find a couple of chubby ladies in large print dresses to stand between. Now, if you can work that all up, you see, you can end up by being in the paper all the time looking better than everybody else in every picture. Now, if you can work this correctly, you see, pretty soon everybody in town knows you. Now, this was very important to me. So after a year or so, I found out that everybody in Haverhill knew Miss Chapman, so that when I walked down Merrimack Street, I could be assured that people would sort of nod at me, and some of the pupils would bow, and I thought this was fitting. And so as I would function in Haverhill, I really found that pretty soon everybody did know me. Now, this was very important to me because, you see, I had all these goals, and I had goals that were important. I wanted to be totally educated. I wanted to be a gracious lady. I wanted to have a job with a lot of money. I wanted to be well-dressed because, as I mentioned, I never had much before. Everything was very dull, and, of course, when I bought these clothes, I bought things that would really show, and I liked things that had a floating chiffon panel so I could make big entrances into rooms. And I practiced walking into rooms like Loretta Young. I wanted to make sure that never again did I walk in unnoticed, and I'm sure I didn't. And so I had all these goals. And now, besides all of those, I was even well-known in the community. And so by the time I was 23 years old, I really had achieved all the goals that I had set out in life. Now, there is only one fear that begins to creep into the heart of a single English teacher as she approaches 23 in the hills of Massachusetts. And what's that? Marriage. What if you never find a man? Now, I had been too busy up to that point making myself perfect to look for men. And unfortunately, no men had been looking for me. So I felt it was time that I begin a new approach. And so I began to look around town. Now, there may be some of you here tonight that have done the same types of thing that I have, that started out, some of you, of course, I'm sure, coming from this prestigious group, are millionaires. But there may be a few of you who did not start out that way and who had to work your way up, as I did. Now, for those of you people who are like that and who had to really work at it, you will realize that one of the real problems with having made yourself so wonderful is that there are very few men left that are good enough for you. Now, this is really a problem, because after all that effort and work, surely one does not wish to marry downhill. So I looked around, and I realized that, unfortunately, there was not a lot of romantic potential in Haverhill, and there was not much, certainly, that would be fitting for me. So as I looked around, I narrowed it down to two possibilities. One was a young doctor, a local doctor, and he had four things going for him. He graduated from Phillips Andover Academy, from Harvard Med School. His father was president of the most prestigious, in fact, only bank in Haverhill. And he was an only child and sure to inherit the family fortune. Now, for me, in those days, those were four very strong credentials for marriage. They don't even sound bad now. But in those days, should I try again? But in those days, they really sounded pretty good to me. There were only two problems with him. One of them was he had a strange and unusual attachment to his mother. Now, that's never good for those of you girls who may not be married. Never find one who's attached to his mother. I mean, they should be respectful, but not attached. And so he was attached to her. And the second problem with him was that he was ugly. Oh, he was ugly. And I would look at him, and I would say to myself, could you wake up every morning the rest of your life and look at him and be happy? Now, the very thought of that turned me in the other direction, to the only other single man in town who was worthy of me, and that was the local priest. Now, he was tall, dark, and handsome. And he looked as if he were about to sing the lead in Going My Way. And I used to meet him at many of the social and cultural events in town. And as I would look at him and see how gorgeous he was, I would say to myself, my, what a waste. However, in those days, it was not considered good form to chase the local priest. So consequently, I continued to date the doctor. I dated him for over a year, during which time he did not so much as kiss me goodnight. And at the end of that year, he announced that he was going to stay home with his mother, which is where he is today. The father died, removing the triangle, and he is still home with his mother. I don't think he knows how often I talk about him. And at the same time that he decided to stay home with his mother, and this is the truth, the priest ran away and married one of his parishioners. I was speaking one night in Boston on a radio program and telling this story, and as I got to that point, a lady in the front screamed right out and stood up and turned around to the rest and said, "That's right, I was in that church," and he did run off and marry one of his parishioners. This was, as you can imagine, a terrible scandal in Haverhill. And off he went with her. And, of course, the disappointing thing was that he was off with the wrong one. Had I realized that he was available, I would have put my attention in a better direction. And who knows, had I been able to pursue the local priest, I might be today a Mother Superior. But unfortunately, it was too late. And I had exhausted all the available men in Haverhill. Now, that summer, I went off to Maine. Now, from out here in California, most of you don't even know there is a state of Maine. But it is the last thing before you go into the ocean, the very end, far corner. And if you think men were hard to find in Haverhill, you can imagine what they were like in the woods of Maine. In Maine, they have more cows than people, and most of the people are women. So when I went up there, it was rather a sparse chance that I might find anybody up in Haverhill, up in Maine. And I had gone up there every summer for 4 years, and I knew there wasn't much around. But I went up that summer to teach again at Camp Trebor, which is Robert spelled backwards. And that was the name of the camp. And so before we could get out of camp on Friday evenings to go out for our one night a week that we were allowed off the grounds when they opened the gates and let us counselors out, we had to put on our little camp counselor costume. Now, I find out here in California, everything's so casual. You don't have the elite costumes that we had in the East. And so I had to put on this little outfit, and just to kind of picture it, I had baggy navy blue pants, a white man's shirt with a necktie, sleeveless, V-neck, itchy navy blue wool vest, and a large white felt pine tree applique on the front of me here, with a large letter T on top of it, which stood for Trebor. Camp Trebor. And this pine tree, flat right here, obliterating what little shape I did have. And then on my head, a little crew hat with another tree and another T. Now, can you picture that? I mean, there I am, a tree here and a tree there. Baggy little pants and necktie, and off I went that night. Now, to get off the grounds, we had to wear this, so in case we got into trouble in town, they would know where to send us back to. So that evening, as I went off, I had with me Janice, the sailing counselor. And she and I roomed together. And so Janice, the sailing counselor, dressed in an identical outfit. We looked like a pair of bookends. And off we went to Naples, Maine, to the Howard Johnsons, the social mecca of the area. And this Howard Johnsons was not what you picture. It didn't even have an orange roof. In fact, it was just a little gray shanty hanging over the edge of a stagnant pond full of floating fudgicle wrappers. There in that unlikely setting in front of that Howard Johnson's, no doubt the first one he'd ever built, probably built by Howard himself. And as we got there, Janice and I, in our little outfits, draped ourselves seductively over a rock in front of Howard Johnson's and began looking for action. I can tell that some of you have looked for action. If action is not looking for you, you have to look for action. So there we were. And as we looked out over, saw nothing but little boy counselors in short pants, which was hardly my style. And so as I looked up, hoping that something better would come by, much to my absolute amazement, over a bridge, over the stagnant pond, right there in front of Howard Johnson's, through the mist, came a tall, handsome young man. And I looked up and I said to myself, that has got to be the best-looking thing you've seen in the woods of Maine in many a summer. And as I looked him over, I thought, now how am I going to get to meet him? And I see, I had spent my whole life getting ready for this moment. I had prepared myself for this. You see, I was totally educated. My father had trained us from the time we were very young that we should have a large vocabulary, that we should be able to speak quickly, and I did well at that, right? And that we should be able to enunciate everything clearly, to pronounce words well, to have good diction, pronunciation, and that we should be able at any time to give quick answers, whatever was asked us. And he had taught us things from the time we were very young in order to use our vocabulary and to use words. By the time I was 3 years old, I recited the entire second chapter of Luke in church for the Christmas pageant. When I was 4 years old, I was taught, and my brothers after me the same thing, to say things such as people who live in transparent domiciles should refrain from hurling geological specimens promiscuously. He also taught us before we went to kindergarten that in case the teacher asked us something we did not know the answer, we were all to recite back quickly and intelligently, not knowing to any degree of accuracy, I dare not assert for fear of erring therein. Now, when you have such phrases as that under your complete control, you can fit in just about anywhere in life. And so as I sat there in that rock, I began to review all the things that I had prepared for this grand moment. And I reviewed my vocabulary, and then I thought about my training, my etiquette training, the modeling lessons I'd taken so I could do pivot turns. And as I began to think of all these things while I was there on the rock, hoping that I would somehow get to meet him, and as I was doing this in my mind, Janice, the sailing counselor, jumped up and ran over. The young man and woman with him had gone to college with Janice. They knew each other, and they had this marvelous reunion. Well, the amazing thing is that I thought, here, now he is standing alone. Here is my big chance. So I rose gracefully from the rock, did a pivot turn, looked up at him, and as I began to speak to him in my flawless English and my large vocabulary, I began to impress him so that he would want to take me out. Gratefully, he did ask me out. Now, he told me later it was not that I had such charm or any vocabulary that impressed him. It was the fact that he needed a date. He didn't know a single girl in the woods of Maine, and he could tell I was, if nothing else, obviously single. So we did go out, and he told me that he would like to come and visit me, and so a few weeks later, he came up to Haverhill, and I did not realize at that time the shock that he was in for when he found out that I lived in three rooms behind my father's store. And when he found the address and came there, I'm sure it was something that was more than he had expected, because while I did not realize it at that time, that he lived in an English Tudor mansion and had a maid in uniform. Now, these were things that no one ever had in Haverhill, never even heard of in Haverhill, and I didn't realize it at that time. As he came to visit me and sat eating in front of all the customers, sat under the one lone light bulb, and I later found out the crystal chandelier that his family sat under, and I hadn't really minded that light bulb until I'd seen there was something better. And we sat out there in the store in front of all the customers, and I didn't realize what a shock and how difficult this was for him. After he'd been there for a day or so, he told me that, he said, "You're really a nice girl, but I just know I could never marry you." And I hadn't expected him to propose on the first visit, but neither did I expect to get canceled out so quickly. So I asked him what was the problem with me. And he said, "Well, it isn't really that there's something so wrong with you. It's just that I'm a businessman. I have to think of everything in a business-like approach." And he said, "It's so many miles from Larchmont, New York, to Haverhill. My car gets so many miles to the gallon. Gas costs so much a gallon." And he multiplied all this out like a computer, and he came up with this amount of money. And then he said, "If I were going to court you properly," and Fred has always done everything properly. Not a lot of fun, but properly. And he said, "If I were going to court you properly, I would have to come up twice a month." So then he doubled the amount. And then he said, "I'd have to throw in some for depreciation and lunches." And so when he added this all up, he said, "Frankly, when I look at this figure and then at yours, I don't feel it's worth the investment." Now, this was really a discouraging thought. I don't know how many of you have been canceled out so statistically as that. Now, as I told my brothers about this, what he had said, they said, "Well, we don't like him anyway. Stodgy old Fred is what they call him." And they said he doesn't have any sense of humor, and he doesn't fit in with our family. And, of course, our family, my father kept us always talking, and he kept us trying to top each other. We once spent 2 weeks figuring out how to plan a building that would go up and down to save on elevators. Now, that was the kind of thing we spent time on. And And it really did tax our brains a little bit and made us stretch our imaginations. So as we were doing these things, you see, Fred didn't seem to fit in with the rest of us. He didn't have the same kind of a feeling or humor. His family did dull things like count their money. And so he didn't quite know what to do with all of us. And so he didn't know any good stories, and he wasn't seemed able to come up with a punchline. And so my brother said, "Well, if that's the way he feels, fine. We don't like him anyway. Let's just forget stodgy old Fred, and we'll go back to having a good time we had before he came." Because I'd been making them be on their good behavior. And so I decided, why bother? So I dropped all my pseudo-manners and my pivot turns, and I just relaxed and behaved the way I had before Fred came along. A day later, he said to me, "Ever since I told you I couldn't marry you, you seem to have relaxed and you seem to have improved." He said, "I was wondering if I could stay around a few more days and see if you continue to shape up." And that puts you right at ease. And I'm sure most of you would have sent him packing, but you were not a single English teacher in Haverhill, Massachusetts, with no options. And so I decided, well, a Fred in the hand is worth two in the bush, and so I let him stay. And so he stayed around, and after two more days, he said to me, "I have now changed my original evaluation, and I am going to put you on a 3-month probation period." So he did, and he came up and dated me twice a month properly, just as he said he would. And 1 year later, he took me for a ride in Central Park in one of those cabs with the driver with the tall hat and the whip, the horse. And we trotted through Central Park, and he passed me a big box, and in it was a big white orchid and this diamond ring. Well, as somebody who likes it, that's wonderful. This morning's group didn't even notice that it was so huge. And So I realized in such an elite group as this that naturally I can't hope to impress you with the size of my diamond, but while it may not be too big here, it was definitely the largest one in Haverhill. And so I went back there, and not being one to want to do things in a small way, I gathered together all my drama pupils Monday afternoon after school in the high school auditorium, and I stood on the stage and I announced to them all, Miss Chapman is going to get married. Now, in those days, pupils liked their teachers. And they all decided immediately that they would like to help with the wedding. And never being one to turn down free labor, I thought that sounded very good. So I decided what we would do, we would play this whole wedding as a giant-sized senior class play. And that I already had the committees planned and motivated, and so I figured we'll do that, and we will make it a coronation. Because I always had felt I should have been a queen, and I thought this will really be one of probably my only opportunity. And so we planned this like a coronation. We got all the committees going. We met every Monday afternoon after school, and the committees grew and grew. We got about 500 on the committee, which is a pretty large committee for weddings. And so each week they would have new ideas and come up with new things to do. And so as they did this, I naturally wanted every new and colorful and glamorous idea that could come up. And that was the year when Queen Elizabeth was crowned. And so I watched everything they were getting ready for her, and I doubled it. And so whatever she was going to have done, mine was going to be better. And as the pupils worked on the whole thing, it got almost out of hand. And at one point, one of my more creative pupils wrote into Life magazine and asked if they would like to come out and cover a teacher's wedding where the pupils were doing all the work. And much to my amazement, they called up and said they were going to come out and cover Miss Chapman's wedding. Now, this coronation, as at that point, you see, we had planned this whole thing. The household arts teacher had tatted me a crown, stiff tatting, all glued with pearls, and that was my crown. The household arts girls planned the royal buffet. The woodshop boys made scepters. They cut up broomsticks and sprayed them gold, made scepters for all the bridesmaids to carry. The metal shop boys made display racks for all the gifts. And I let everybody know ahead of time that not only would your gifts be on display at the wedding, but that your name would be written under them. If there are any of you that haven't gotten married yet, I just want to tell you that there is nothing that raises the value of wedding gifts so quickly as letting everybody know that their name will be written under it. You can hardly bring a potholder. We had all these committees going, the one making the scepters and making the display racks and making the wood shops with the scepters, the metal shop with the display racks, the household arts girls with the buffet. The automobile boys found me a white Cadillac to drive me to and from the wedding. And the high school band began to practice the wedding march with my brother at first trumpet. So as we got all of these things going and knew that Life magazine was coming, I tell you, the minute that the word got out, poor old Haverhill went into instant redevelopment. They began to polish up the statue of the thinker in front of the high school, sweep up the streets, polish the windows, get everything ready so that when Life magazine came to Haverhill, it would look good. Everybody wanted to come to my wedding. We had to reprint the invitations, and obviously more invitations, more people. And so as we were doing this and getting everything ready, there was an excitement at Haverhill to find out what was going to happen when Life magazine came. Now, through all of this, I didn't have a lot of time to catch Fred up with the details. And so he arrived from New York the night before the wedding, sort of like a leading man in a play who hadn't even read the script. And we just kind of worked him in and fit it into the plan. And we had this fantastic wedding. All of that was in the era of strapless, fluffy net dresses. So every girl in the high school that could come up with one of those was my court. And I had about 100 girls in my court, and we had loads of bridesmaids. We had everything going on. We had the boys in tuxedos out front, and they were parking all the cars. The police barricaded the entire square in front of the church, and I was so impressed that little insignificant me, who lived in three rooms behind that store, was now having a wedding so important that they had barricaded off the entire square to keep traffic out so that Miss Chapman's wedding could go on uninterrupted. Now, I was so thrilled with what I'd done with myself, and I can remember as I came out of the church that evening that I looked across at the little store, and I said, Florence, you've really done it. You've gotten yourself from a little nobody in that three rooms behind the store. You've gotten yourself totally educated. You're a gracious lady. You've had this job with all this money. Everybody in town knows you. You've been president of everything there is to be president of. You're now marrying a handsome young man from New York with promise. Never amounted to as much as the promise seemed, but I've married him. And now your wedding's going to be in Life magazine. Now, is there anyone here that's done more by the time you're 24 than that? Now, see, I was so thrilled with what I'd done. I did find out, however, right off, something that most women don't know, and that is that after every wedding comes a marriage. So we all know what weddings are. You can see pictures of weddings, but you can't see a picture of a marriage. And so I spent all my time getting ready for the wedding. And I found out that overnight I became stupid. Now, that happened to anybody else here besides me? Anybody got married? Perfectly intelligent, articulate woman one day, next day you were stupid? Just a few of you. The rest of you either lie or are... Well, I got married to this super being from New York, and immediately I found out that all the things that looked so smooth and sophisticated in Haverhill turned shoddy in New York. I went from being the urbane queen of Haverhill, Massachusetts, to becoming Fred's own private Eliza Doolittle. We got back from the honeymoon, which was a disaster in itself, but we got back from the honeymoon, and Fred said to me, "And now I am going to put you on your training program." I said, "What training program?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to have to shape you up and show you the areas that you need help." I said, "Well, I'm already perfect." He said, "You think you're perfect." Well, that was true. I did think I was perfect. He said, "You think you're perfect, but you're really not." And I said, "Well, what areas do you have to work on?" And he said, "Well," he said, "we'll start off with your Boston accent. We have to get rid of that." I said, "I don't have an accent. Everybody up there talks like that." He said, "That's an accent." And he said, "That may sound fine in Haverhill with those little high school kids. But," he said, "when you come down to New York, it will never go in the society down here. We must get rid of your accent." So he made me stop every time I put an R in where it didn't belong or left one out where it should have been. He made me repeat the word 5 times until I got it right. Now, for someone that talks as fast and as much as I do, you have to repeat every few words 5 times. It really slowed me down. And I didn't like this much at all. Then he said, "I will have to teach you how to walk." I said, "What do you mean, teach me how to walk?" I said, "I've taken modeling, did some turns for him, showed him what I could do." He said to me, he said, "You think you walk well, but," he said, "actually your feet turn out." And he said, "Your feet are supposed to go straight ahead." And he said, "My mother always taught me that." And so we had little tiles on our foyer floor in our New York apartment. And so every evening when I was just back from my honeymoon, I had to walk up and down the tiles 10 times till I could go without my feet going over the crack. Now, I didn't like this a lot. You may have sensed that I was not one who wanted to be told what to do. And I already knew how to do everything. And so I found out here I was being retrained. I'd already trained myself. And so then he said to me, "One of the other things, you have to learn how to answer the telephone." And I thought I did fine. I said, "Hello." And that's what everybody in Haverhill said. He said, no, that would not go, that was an uncouth way of answering the phone, and that what I had to do was to say, "Good evening, this is Florence Littower. With whom did you wish to speak?" Now, I thought even for me that was a bit wordy. But he would call me up 4 or 5 times a day to spot check my responses. I found out he was really serious about training me. He showed me how to cook. He was a manager in Stoker's Restaurant at Fifth Avenue in New York, and he wanted to show me how to cook. Now, I thought I knew how to cook, but he showed me that I should never put 2 vegetables of the same color on the same plate at the same time, and I'm sure none of you ever do this, or any vegetables of the same consistency, like little round things or mushy things, that they should all be of different consistencies and never put them at the same time, that you had to put watercress on every plate, and I didn't even know what watercress was, and I can tell some of you don't either, and... I had to preheat the dinner plates and pre-chill the salad plates and forks. Now, by the time I got all that through my head and got the whole thing cooked and put in front of him, I was a nervous wreck. Now, I found out I didn't really like much about this marriage. And one day he watched me doing dishes and he counted up and he said, "Do you realize that you made 42 unnecessary moves?" Now, I'd never known anybody that counted moves when one was doing dishes. So I threw a sponge at him. And he looked at me, and he said to me, "I think it's only logical that someone with superior knowledge should share it with someone less gifted." Now, I see you're ready to stone him. That's wonderful. I'll tell him that. Because you probably think I didn't last that long with him, but it's 28 years and 2 weeks. So, just shows what stamina I have. Well, actually, what it really shows is that the option was going back to Haverhill. When I thought about that, he didn't look so bad. So, plus the fact, you do have to bear in mind that Fred was exceptionally handsome. And that as long as I keep my eyes on looking at him and not listening to him, I could do all right. And so he ran me through all his training program. You see. Well, after a while, I realized that this wasn't a lot of fun. And my total preparation for marriage had been reading 2 copies of Bride's Magazine. And it had all looked so good. And my mother's total instruction to me was the week before I got married, she said, "Do you know what it's all about?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Thank goodness." So with that amount of knowledge, I went into marriage. And so as things went on, I realized that this wasn't getting any better. And because of the fact that I couldn't say any words with R's in them to Fred, I ended up not talking a lot to him. And I found other people I could talk to. And I began to ask for advice among the girls in my apartment. Now, that's a wonderful place to go for marriage counsel. to other mixed-up girls in your apartment. And and they all had bad marriages, I found out. Well, that made me feel better, because I thought I was the only one. But when I found out that they all had terrible marriages, and they told me it was just one day of mutual forbearance after another, then I thought, when I heard what their husbands were doing, Fred didn't look all bad. So I thought, well, I'll just settle in. That's the way it's supposed to be. I thought it was going to be fun, but I didn't realize it was such a drag. So I decided, well, all right, that's the way it'll have to be. So I just established a pattern. And after a while, one of the girls suggested to me, why don't you have a baby that'll take off the pressure? That if you have this cute little thing sitting around the house in a tub of bubbles, that your husband will be so intrigued with it that he will just look at it and he will be so excited about this little baby that he won't worry about how you do the housework or how you dust or cook or any of those things. And so I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. No one gave me a better one. And so I decided, well, good, I'll have a baby. And I can tell, of course, that some of you have already made the same mistake. And so I did get pregnant, and I had this little baby, and I thought, well, no, this is going to be it. So give me a new thing to play with, something new to do in life. And when I took the first look at that baby, and I don't know how your first one looked, but I took first look at that baby, and I tell you, that had to be the ugliest looking thing I've ever seen in my life. Now, I had figured, because Fred was so good looking, and I had shaped up somewhat, that I thought that I would have this cute little thing look just like a Gerber jar. But instead, I had this poor ugly baby. She looked like one of those little heads you buy in the florist shops. Little clay heads with the wrinkles on them. She had a red face, the same color. And those ones that grow grass out of the tops of the head. I mean, she had this bright red face with wrinkles. Her nose was pushed over to one side. Her eyes met under the bridge of her nose together. And her hair stood up like spikes all over her head. I mean, she really looked like you'd planted seed on her. And when I took one look at that baby, I thought the whole idea must have been a mistake. She was so ugly, I used to put on big bonnets, pull the blankets way up, put up the back of the carriage, and hope nobody ever asked to see my baby. But the worst problem was that once I got home, I found out that Fred had read 3 books on motherhood. He already knew more about that than I did. So that was discouraging, because I thought just genetically I ought to be better at motherhood than he. But he was better at everything. So I decided, well, if I can't be a success at anything, I'll go out and find myself in the world. So I started doing all the things that women's lib think they were creative with. I did it a long while ago. And I began to go out and find out who I was and get myself into good positions and do things that were glamorous and colorful. And I thought if I could find enough people giving me credit all day, I could stand Fred at night. And so this worked out pretty well. So I went out and I got involved in various different kinds of jobs. I taught English, taught speech, taught psychology, did all kinds of things in that area, did directed professional theater, also became a model, and I did some fashion commentating for Macy's in New York City. So I got all kinds of interesting jobs throughout my life. Not all of those in 1 year, but throughout my life. I've had more colorful positions than probably most people have ever thought of, because I always was attracted to things where I was up front and everybody was looking at me and telling me I was wonderful. So I thought this was the way to go. So as I went out to work, I worked for 4 years before my husband mentioned that he really did want to have a son. Now, I thought, having this one mistake, I really didn't need another one. But he did feel, and for those of you that are disturbed that this poor child is still ugly, if she was still ugly, I wouldn't even let you know I had her. I would have just kept her in a closet. But she shaped up, and she looked all right. And I do have some pictures here, I think, tonight. Just we've got a red scrapbook of pictures of me through my various stages. And so that you will know that what I'm telling you is really the truth, documented here in living black and white. And as she grew up to be 3 or 4 years old, my husband wanted a son, and so I decided, well, I didn't start this thing too young anyway, and so if I'm going to have one more child, I had better get it over with. And some of you, I'm sure, perhaps had this same thought somewhere along the line. And so I had my second child. At that time, I was teaching English and speech at North Haven, Connecticut High School, and I prided myself on the fact that one thing I could also do well was that I could be pregnant and have no one know it. And the day that Marita was born, I modeled in a fashion show, and no one even knew I was pregnant. So I thought that was really good. And so I went to the hospital that afternoon, and of course it was supposed to be Frederick Jerome Littauer III, but it turned out to be Marita. And this was definitely a disappointment. Is there anyone here that ever had to produce a son and kept coming up with daughters besides me? Yes, really bad. And so, of course, the minute that happens, what is it that you know then? What do you got to do? You got to have another one. We got to keep this thing going. And so I figured, well, while I've got the crib out and the diapers and the playpen, the jumpseat and all the things that you need out, that I might as well have the other one and get it over with. So a year and a half later, I had my third child. At that time, I was teaching speech at the University of Connecticut, and the class of college students did not even know I was pregnant, and my husband showed up to give the final exam on the final night while I was in the hospital having the baby, and they didn't even realize that I could even have been there. And so I was thrilled again that I had pulled off something else that I did so well. So he came to the hospital that night, and he congratulated me because I had a son, Frederick Jerome Littauer III, and he looked at me and he said, "Finally, you've done something right."
This is the end of side one. Please turn cassette over for the rest of this testimony.
Now, I was so grateful that I had done something right. Now, at this point, as I had this little child, an adorable little baby, beautiful, looked just like my husband, platinum blonde hair, which Fred had. Fred had silver blonde, platinum hair. I mean, just gorgeous, and he always had a tan. Looked just like all the California surfers look, only better. And so I had this baby, looked just like him. I was so thrilled that they didn't look like me, except Lauren, the ugly one. But the other ones looked like my husband. And so here was this gorgeous thing, the best looking of all of them, with a beautiful hair and dimples and sparkling eyes and long curly eyelashes and a little turned up nose, everything just exactly right. So when I brought him home from the hospital, I was really delighted to think that finally I'm over this. I now can settle down and be happy with everything I've got. And I began to recount what I had. We had bought a 6-room ranch house in the best part of town in North Haven, Connecticut, the best street. And we had doubled the size of it, making it a 12-room home with 4 bedrooms on an acre of land. And I had done everything that I wanted. I had decorated the whole home perfectly. I had it all looking like store windows, to the point that my husband one day said to me, "I wish there was one chair in this house I'd dare to sit in." But I had it perfect. You couldn't relax a lot, but it looked good. And so I was very happy with how I put things together, so I began to review how well I'd done. I now had this marvelous huge house. I had 3 fur coats, a seal, a mink, and a black seal. A seal with the sables. I've got that with me. It's a little tattered now, but I have it with me in case it gets cold up here. So I had all of these marvelous fur coats. I had a Lincoln Continental that I was able to drive around, and I had achieved the ultimate status symbol in my mind, which was to have a maid in uniform. And when you have all those things, you can feel pretty good about how well you've done in life. So I can remember when I came home from the hospital holding this child that I looked out the back window to my beautiful yard, and I said to myself, "Florence, you've really made it. You must be happy now." And I began to recount all the things that I had. Now, I've learned, as I counsel a lot of mixed-up women and people that have got really many, many problems, that any time you've got to convince yourself you're happy, you probably aren't. And yet I stood there and told myself, "You must be happy. You have all of these things." And I listed them over and over and over to myself. And you've even got this son now, so you don't have to worry about being a mother any longer or trying again. And so I was very happy because I had the maid to take care of the children, which is what I thought was the best way to go. And I was out saving the world and doing exciting and creative things. So I thought, now, if life can go on like this, then finally now I'm happy. Plus the fact that my husband was in his own business doing very well at it, and he was so busy making money for me to spend that I never saw him much. And I found out that Fred and I got along the best in marriage when we didn't see each other, and that if we could only stay apart long enough, that we could get along pretty well. So we had worked things out nicely. I had a maid to take care of the children, so I didn't have to worry about them. Had a nice big house, had enough money, had the cars, the fur coats, everything. And my husband was too busy to bother me and just furnished me with a lot of money. We had a 50-50 arrangement. He earned, I spent. And the only problem was I have always been more talented in my area. But so I really felt that everything was in good shape. Now, as this child got to be 6 and 7 months old, I noticed that he was not doing as much as he had done before, so I decided, well, boys are slower. And as I would come in now and then and look at him, I would feel that there seemed to be something wrong with him. And as he got a little bit older, he began to scream in the night, and I would get up and go into him, and the poor little thing would have his head way back stiff, and his little fingers would be tensed up like this, and his body would be straight as could be. And I didn't know what was wrong with him. I never had this happen to my other children. And I would rub him and pat him, and little Lauren, who was about 6 or 7 at that time, would come in and help me with him, and we would stand over him and try to calm him. And it was difficult to do, but after a while he would stop crying and he'd go back to sleep. So after this went on for a few weeks and got worse, I realized there's got to be something wrong. So I took him down to my pediatrician. At that point I was directing musical theater, musical comedy, South Pacific and things along that line, and I was pulling together all the staff of talented people. And so I went down to my pediatrician, who was one of my leading men in my musicals, and I took the baby down to him and I said, "Dick, there's something wrong with this child. I don't quite know what it is, but I'd like you to look him over. Whatever it is, fix it up, because this is Fred's namesake and we can't let anything happen to him." So I said, "Whatever money it takes, we'll get it, but you fix the child, find out what it is, and do it." So I was in there for a while, and he sent me out. He said, "You go out and wait out front." So I went and sat out in the waiting room for a while. He called in a specialist from across the hall, and after a while they called me back in. And I certainly was not ready for what he told me. And he looked at me and he said, "Florence, as a friend, I hate to tell you this, but I'm afraid that this child is hopelessly brain damaged." I couldn't believe that, and I looked at him and I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I think that his brain is not functioning correctly, and I'm afraid you're going to have to gear your mind to forget this child and put him away and perhaps have another one." And I said, "Dick, now that's ridiculous. If you don't know how to fix this child, if you find someone who does, certainly there's some doctor in this country who knows how to put this child together. So you find him and you fix him up. Whatever money it takes, you get it done. And he looked at me and said, Florence, I don't think you understand. He said, this is something that your money and your willpower can't do anything about. Now, that stopped me in my track because no one had told me ever in life that there was anything that my money and my willpower couldn't do something about. And he said to me, this child is hopeless. Now, I never heard that word applied to anything in life. Hopeless. There always was hope. That was the big thing growing up in the Depression, that while things were bad, there was hope. You always knew it would be better tomorrow. And you worked hard and you got there. And I knew I could do it, and I'd done it myself, and I'd done it my own power. And yet here was somebody saying to me, this child of yours, your husband's namesake, is hopeless. I couldn't believe that. So I said, and you find someone else. I want another opinion. So he got an appointment with a psychiatrist that did testing on that Saturday, and my husband and I took the baby there. And the man went over and gave him a lot of tests. And he ended up telling me the same thing. This child is hopelessly brain damaged. Put him away, forget him, and have another one. Now, those of you that have had children know that you can't take a beautiful child that's yours and just put him away and forget him. You just can't do that. And I kept clinging to the hope that somebody was going to find something to do with this child. I called different doctors. I took him different places. I went to my obstetrician, and he said, I think you should have another one. He said, it will take your mind off this. And he said, as the child was deteriorating, he was then having 10 to 12 convulsions a day, screaming most of the time. I had to have help in there just to watch him during the day. We did 3 shifts. I had 2 girls in the day that took care of him, and I stayed up with him all night. And as we rotated this around, our life became close to unbearable. But as I did get pregnant and plan to have a 4th child, I obviously had a lot of time to sit around and think about myself. Up to this point in life, I had kept myself so busy, and I think a lot of us do this, we keep ourselves so busy we don't have time to really think what's wrong with us. We don't have time to realize that we're not happy, that we're not content, that things aren't the way we really wish they were. And so as I sat there for that 9 months waiting to have that last child, I had an opportunity to analyze myself. And when you're sitting there holding a dying child, it really makes a big difference what things are important to you in life. And as I sat there with him, I looked around at this house that I had made into a shrine. I looked at this wall-to-wall carpeting, marble dining room floor, hand-painted mural in the living room wall. I'd had my drapes custom woven in Denmark so that they would match the mural. I'd had everything done to perfection. But when you're holding a dying child, it didn't really make much difference what's painted on the walls. And it doesn't matter if you're driving around in a Lincoln Continental. It doesn't make a bit of difference whether you're wearing a fur coat. And so as I sat holding him, I thought, I've spent my whole life working to get these things, and now I've got something in my arms that's hopeless. Something that I can't do anything about. As the doctor said, nothing that my willpower or my money could do anything about. My husband had been involved in his entire life in a religious cult that believed in a certain type of healing. And so his mother mentioned that probably the problem with this child was the fact that I did not subscribe to their religion, and that if only I would do that and go to one of their healers, that he would be better. And so I can remember, while I was pregnant with this 4th one, that I went in and out of New York once a week to a healer to try to get my son saved and changed. But nothing worked. And the man used to tell me every week, he looked at me and he said, when you can look at that child and know there's nothing wrong with him, he will be well. Now this put all the guilt on me. And so not only was I brokenhearted that I had this child, not only was I desperately depressed, even though at the time I would not have put that label on it because I didn't even know the word, but I also then was told that the whole problem with this child was the fact that I could not look at him and say he was well. And so I had the guilt besides. So as this time went on, this pregnancy was an extremely difficult, close to excruciating time as I sat there holding this dying child and wondering what was going to happen. When I went to the hospital to have my 4th child, after I had given up all my presidencies, all the various things that I did, and pretty much become a recluse at that time, when I went to the hospital to have this child, my husband put his namesake into a small children's hospital in northern Connecticut. And when I came out of the hospital, little Freddie was gone, and I never saw him again. My husband and I did the only thing we knew how to do in grief and tragedy at that time, which was to run away from it, to try to pretend it had never happened. We never mentioned Freddie again. My husband had the whole room wallpapered, the nursery, new crib, everything done, and there was no memory of Freddie left. And I decided, well, the only thing that's going to make me unhappy in life is that I've got this one child. And I had gone through a program at Yale New Haven where they had tested me ahead of time. It was a program for mothers who had brain-damaged children. And they had monitored his heartbeat and his brain waves as I was delivering him. And they had proclaimed him to be perfect. And so I thought, well, at least I've got this one perfect child. And I'm going to devote my time to taking care of him and watching over him. So I became, for the first time in my life, a real mother. I actually watched over him. I didn't let anyone else touch him. I became almost a fanatical mother. And I began to pay attention to my daughters, found out how lonely they were, found out that I really hadn't really gotten to know them at all in life. I'd been so busy doing other things. And so at this time, I had a transition in my life where I was there, depressed still over the dying child in the hospital, but hopeful that at least this one was going to be all right. 6 months from the time this one was born, this one was Lawrence Chapman Littauer, 6 months from the time he was born, exactly to the day, he was born August 14th. On February 14th, as I was preparing a Valentine's Day party for my two little girls, I got a call from the hospital saying that Freddie had died. He had strangled to death in the night. He had pneumonia. No one had been there as he coughed and he choked. He had choked himself to death. My husband and I were really unhappy, disturbed, distraught. We had a little funeral, private funeral, up in the hospital in northern Connecticut, and he and I went up there and saw our son laid out in this little casket. There's nothing much more gripping than to see your child lying in a casket. And as I looked down at this child, not only was he skinny, little tiny round arms and legs, but his whole face was bruised from where he'd been having convulsions and hit his head against the side of the crib, and no one had taken care of it. And as I looked at him, the worst thing that struck me was the fact that he was being laid out in charity clothes. Since he'd been up there, I had never thought where his clothes came from. And yet, as I looked at these little tattered clothes that he was laid out in the casket, I realized, my son, I, who wore charity clothes as a child, who'd become so wonderful, who has this money and everything, and my child is laid out in charity clothes. I just could hardly ever get over that. And I came back home, and I thought, well, at least I've got little Larry, and I'm going to bring him up right, and he's going to be my prize. 1 week from the day that Freddie died, I went in to pick up little Larry from his bed. And as I looked at him, he just didn't seem to be right. And I can remember waving my hand over him, and there was no response. His eyes just didn't seem to be focusing on me correctly. So I picked him up, and I shook him, and he didn't seem to respond. And I remember I put him right in the car. I drove right down to the doctor's. I marched right in. I went right by everybody else in the waiting room. I went right in and found Dick where he was, and I said, Dick, I don't know what you're doing right now, but you've got to come and look at this child. And he knew my problem, so he ran right out and looked at him. And he went in the room with me. He examined him again with a few tests. And I'll never forget, he looked at me, and he said, Florence, I'm afraid it's the same thing. I said, Dick, it can't be the same thing. I can't live through this again. I could not live through this again, Dick. And he said, well, I hope you don't have to, but I'm afraid it's the same thing. He made an appointment for me to go to Johns Hopkins Metabolic Research Unit in Baltimore, Maryland. But it was months before I could get the appointment, before I could get there. And in that time, he went drastically downhill. He began to have convulsions just like his brother. And he began to scream and cry in the night. And by the time I got him to Johns Hopkins, I was really almost sure that there was no hope for him. I can remember the first afternoon as I took him in there. I'd flown down in an airplane holding this little child in my lap. He was 1 year old at the time. I was trying to hold his head up so he'd look normal for the people on the plane. I was always so concerned about how things looked to other people. And I held up his little head, which was always teetering over, in order to hold it up straight so that people would think he was normal. And I can remember taking him to the hospital. In the first afternoon, as Dr. Robert Cook, who was head of the unit, looked at me, and I asked him about what chance there was for him. And I remember as he looked at me, he said, Florence, you know better than to ask for hope. And I had that word again. He's hopeless. They operated on his brain, and they found out he didn't have one. When they got in there to find out, instead of the convolutions that he was supposed to have, a little tiny round ball, nothing that was working for him at all. We brought him home a week later, bandaged, bruised, a living vegetable. They told us he would not live very long at all. But unfortunately, he lived 19 years. He just died last month. For 19 years, we've had the burden of this child. He's been in the same hospital where his little brother died, and he never grew at all. Up until last month when he passed away, he was exactly the same size he was at 1 year old when he was put in there. Now, I'm sure you can imagine at that particular point in my life that I didn't feel it was a lot worth living for. I, the one who had set myself up to do well, the one who had programmed everything in life to suit me, the one who had made everything go my way and been able to manipulate and control any set of circumstances that I'd ever come across, except these two, was faced again with the word hopeless, something that your money and your willpower can't do anything about. Now, at that time, I know now that I was deeply depressed. I didn't realize it at the time, but this is why I have ended up counseling women that are depressed, not because I like that, because my spirit is not a depressed spirit, basically, but I've been there, and I know what it's like. So I spend a lot of time with depressed women. I've written a book on overcoming depression because of the fact that I know what it's like to be in a situation where it's hopeless. And that's what depression is, a place where you can't do anything about it. At this particular time, my sister-in-law, Rosie, the same one that I had met on that rock up in Naples, Maine, she asked me if I would go to a Christian women's club with her. Now, I didn't need anyone to tell me that I needed religion, because I'd already been a religious person, hadn't worked. I had been to church, I'd done the right things. And there may be many of you here today that have come out of churches where you could go forever and never learn anything. Where you could sit there every week and never know a person. Where you could listen to the pastor every single Sunday and never come up with the truth that would help you. And that's the kind of situation I've been in. And so I didn't know there was anything beyond that. And I knew I didn't need any more religion. I'd had it, and it didn't work. But my sister-in-law asked me to go to a Christian women's club, and I thought, well, I wonder what that's going to be like. And I refused her many times, because I thought, I don't really want to go to any group of stodgy little old ladies in black dresses, kneeling in a corner over a Bible, chanting something or doing something strange. And I didn't want any of that. So I thought, I don't want to go to that kind of a group. And so I refused to go, but she kept asking me. And for those of you that have been asking friends and they've said no, keep asking. Lovingly, nicely, sweetly. Not being annoyed with them when they don't go, but just asking. And she kept telling me every month what they were going to have for a special feature. And this one month, she said they're going to have a fashion show. And I thought, well, she's going to keep badgering me forever. I'm going to have to go to this thing sooner or later. And a fashion show sounds like the best thing out of all the ones she's mentioned. So I thought, if these religious women look at clothes, they can't be all bad. So I decided I'll go to the fashion show. So I did. And I went there that day, and I wanted to make sure that I looked good. And so I can remember exactly what I wore, a bright ruby red Steel Chapman ensemble, a wool with a satin top with faggoting across it. I had a felt and velvet kind of swirling turban, large brooch on the front. And I had a cut velvet pile handbag, which I still have, that I bought in Lord & Taylor's. And I had custom-dyed, spike-heeled, pointed-toed shoes that matched the dress. And so I was really set. And when I walked into that group, the Christian Women's Club, I wanted to make sure that those religious women knew I wasn't one of them. And I'm sure they did. I sat down and I looked around, and they weren't the kind of group I expected they'd be. Instead of frumpy little ladies, they were all attractive, nice people like you. And as I looked around, I thought, well, this isn't so bad. Then the fashion show was wonderful. They had their own models, and they were all beautiful. And then the man got up to speak, Dr. Roy Gustafson of the Billy Graham team. And he gave a talk that day, and he told about a woman so much like me that I was sure that Ruthie had given him advance information. I listened to what he said about a woman who was so self-centered, so self-righteous, so sure of herself, so concerned that she control everything just her way, and so materialistic. And he said, now there might even be somebody here today that's just like her. And he looked right at me. And I thought, how does he know that I'm like him? And then he said, there might be a person here today who looks beautiful on the outside. And then he pointed at me at that. But she knows that she's miserable inside. I thought, well, he really does know me. And as he went on, he said, if that's the case, maybe you've tried everything in your own power. Maybe you've tried to run things your way, and he recited all the things I've done in life. Went right down the list. And he said, if that's happened to you, and you know it hasn't brought you happiness, and you're miserable today, maybe what you have to do is commit your life to the Lord Jesus. Now, I had committed my life to the Lord Jesus because I had recited verses, and I'd gone to church and Sunday school. I had perfect attendance ribbons and all kinds of badges. And I once won a Bible lotto quiz, so I knew a lot about the Bible. But he said, maybe you have never really known what it was to be a Christian. Maybe you've just been a good church attender. Well, I surely was that, I thought. Well, yeah, I guess I'm that. And he said, if that's the case, maybe today that you need to dedicate your life to the Lord and ask him to commit your heart and change you and make you into what he wants you to be. So I thought about that. I said, I didn't realize that he had any plan for me. And certainly mine hadn't worked. And so as I listened to him, he used two verses, Romans 12, 1 and 2. And he said that what we ought to do is to present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto him, which is our reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world. And that was the phrase that got me. Be not conformed to this world. And I spent my whole life being conformed to the world. And after a while, I'd even started making the world conform to me. And he said, be not conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. And when he got to that phrase, I can remember thinking, I sure need a new mind. Certainly the one I've got now isn't worth a lot. And so as he went on, I thought, that really applies to me. And then he said that when we do that, then we will know what is that good, acceptable, and perfect will of God for you. And I didn't like that part because I knew God didn't have any perfect will for me. Because I'd never done anything wrong in life. I'd always been a good girl. And consequently, I couldn't see if there was any God that he would let me have these two children and have this happen to me. And so when I got to that part, I didn't pay any attention to that good will. But I thought that be not conformed to the world began to bother me. And as I thought about it, I thought, you could tone down a little in that area. And so as I began to think about that, I realized that I definitely needed to get a little bit out of the world because it hadn't brought me all that much. And so as he began to share this, I listened. And I prayed with him that day at the end. And I remember praying in almost a sarcastic tone because I was so hurt and I was so depressed that I didn't want to take a chance of really committing myself to something and then being disappointed again. So I can remember praying in my mind, after he prayed, rather sarcastically, and saying, "Lord, if you can do anything with me, good luck." Now, a lot of times we feel that to commit our lives to the Lord, we've got to be in a cathedral right next to an organ pipe. But I was sitting in the Old Mill Restaurant Dairy in Connecticut, 10 feet from the bar, praying sarcastically. But the Lord knew underneath, my heart was sincere. I had such a need. And I was really crying out to him, even though I wouldn't allow my consciousness to say that. And I left there that day, and I didn't really know what had happened to me. Shortly after that, a young pastor came to our door and asked if I would go to his church. And it was called the Evangelical Baptist Church. And I never really wanted to be a Baptist, and I certainly didn't want to be evangelical. So the idea of the whole thing didn't sound very good to me. But he was very attractive. And he had a lot of personality. Plus, he seemed to be sincere. And I hadn't met a lot of sincere people in my life. And so I decided, all right, I'd go to his church. So I went there that Sunday in a bright red dress with a big white felt hat and streamers down my back. I remember that big rose behind it. I always tended to overdress a bit. And so I went in that day and found myself in a school gymnasium. And that wasn't exactly where I expected to be. And the pastor stood under a basketball hoop, make him holy. And so as I looked around, I realized that these people were dressed in rather ordinary outfits, and I felt somewhat self-conscious in the big white hat, streamers. And so as I sat down there and looked around, I realized that all the people had Bibles with them. Now, I'd never been to a church that had Bibles. The pastor had Bibles, but I mean, people didn't carry them. They didn't need to know anything. And so as I looked around, I saw these people open Bibles, and they started going through them. And I always have figured if you join anything, I mean, you do it all the way. And so the next week, I brought a big Bible with me. Big Bible. Gold edges and ribbons through it. You know, big Bible, gold on the front. Family Bible, family tree and all those things in it. Very important. We bought it at Sears one Christmas so we'd look spiritual. And so I brought this thing to church with me the next Sunday, carry this huge Bible in. And I'd gotten rid of the hat and streamers, so I was down a little bit. And I just carried the big Bible. And then I found that people were marking in their Bibles. Well, I mean, you can't mark in a Bible with gold edges. And so I couldn't mark in that Bible. So I then went out and I bought a Good News Bible. It paid 35 cents. I figured I didn't want to invest too much in religion in case it didn't work. And so I only bought a 35 cent Good News Bible, had the newsprint on the front of it. It was the first time that those had come out. And so I bought that and I began to study it. And then I went to a Bible study that the pastor had, and I began to find out what the Bible really had something to say to me. So I began to mark it up and write things in it and put little circles. And as we find out the temperaments tomorrow, you'll realize that sanguines draw kind of loose circles and arrows and all different colors. You never can find the same pen twice. And so I kind of started going through the Bible and working over this thing, and I began to study it and study it, and now I've got it so worn out now that it's really the only Bible I know, the totally removable Book of Acts. Oh dear, it's really falling apart. In fact, Hebrews is not too good either. A little messy, too. My husband, being a melancholy, can't figure out how in the world I can even function through this Bible. But I remember not by the verses, but by that it's a red square on the side of the page, and I know where it is so I can find it. So I began to study the Bible and find out that it actually meant something to me. Now, I'd never known it was supposed to mean anything. I mean, I knew Adam and Eve and David and Goliath and things like that, but I didn't know it was supposed to actually mean anything. So as I started reading on my own, I found out right here in Matthew, right at the very beginning, right at the beginning here in chapter 6, it said in here, 6:3, it said, and this is the version, that when you do something for a needy person, you should do it in such a way that even your best friend doesn't know that you did it. Now, that bothered me, because I thought, why would you do anything to somebody if you didn't get credit? I certainly would be disappointed in giving things that people didn't see you give them. And I had I felt I was subtle about it, but I had always made sure that I did my giving at prime viewing time. The more people watching, the better. And, of course, I would do it quietly, but always when all eyes were in that direction. Now, when I read this verse, this is the first verse that spoke to me in here. And I thought, does that really mean that if I'm going to be a real Christian, that I have got to do things with people and not get any credit? And it was just like the Lord said, yes, that's what I mean. And, oh, well, I'm not going to do this anymore. Because I just knew I couldn't handle that. But I kept getting back to that verse, and after a while I began to work on it. And I can't tell you that I just love to do things without credit yet. But I have learned that I can. And it's become a little easier to me. Now, it may be easy for all of you, but that's a very difficult one for me. Then as I went along, I found 1 Corinthians 13:5 says, love does not keep a record of wrongs. And I had such a record of wrongs against Fred. I mean, I just had it. You already hate him, don't you? And so you know all that list. Terrible, terrible list. And so I had all that list against him. And I realized that if this Bible meant anything, and it says love does not keep a record of wrongs, and I have a record of wrongs against Fred, then just by sheer logic, what does that mean about my feelings for him? That I what? Don't love him. Now, I didn't like to even think that. Because we never hit each other or anything. We're very mannerly about our behavior. We try to stay as much away from each other as we could, but we never really had any fights or anything. And so I had never faced the fact that I never loved Fred right from the start. And so I began to think about that. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. And I realized that I guess what I had better do, and I realized this reluctantly, was I had better start praying to get rid of the record of wrongs. And I had it so firmly ingrained in me that every night when I would do the dishes, I would put my hands in the water. It was like turning on a switch in my head. And my head would start reciting all the things wrong with Fred from the moment we got married, right down the list. And then I would add on today's list. And so I had to work this over. So every day as I was doing this, I was adding on and reviewing and reviewing and reviewing. Now, when I started working on that verse, I prayed weekly, Lord, take away my record of wrongs. And bit by bit, not in a hurry, but bit by bit, the Lord began to get so that once a week I could do dishes without reciting what was wrong with Fred. And after a while, it got so I could do them almost every night without that. So it took almost a year to get rid of my record of wrongs, because I really didn't want to. Why is it we don't want to get rid of our record of wrongs? Because if we lost it all, what would we not have available? All this ammunition. Because I knew that in that great day of comeuppance, that when God called us together, I wanted to be there with the biggest list and say it the fastest. Now see, if you throw that all away, it's got nothing to work with. And I find out as I deal with women today that most of them don't want to get rid of the record of wrongs. It's not that the husband is so terrible, and it's not that they couldn't get rid of them. It's just that they want to be sure they've got the edge, that they've got the control, and that when the time comes they can really do them in. And so most women just aren't willing to do any better, and I wasn't either. So it took a long time to get rid of that list. And then after I got rid of the list, I realized that if I had now got rid of the list but I did not really love him. And I can remember one day when that struck me. And I was just really a new Christian then and had not had a lot of experience in what the Lord wanted out of my life. But I can remember dropping on my knees beside my bed and saying, Lord, cause me to fall in love with Fred. Now, you know, when I look back at it, Fred wasn't all that bad. I made him sound terrible. But you know, the worst thing about Fred was that he tried to make me perfect. And I rebelled against it because I already thought I was. So you see, when you look at it from another point of view, if I hadn't been so strong-willed and arrogant, Fred wouldn't have had to work so hard on me, and I might have liked him better. So I began to pray that the Lord would cause me to fall in love with him, and he did. And I want to share with you women who don't love your husbands tonight that God will give you a love from him when you're willing. But I find so many women aren't willing. And so I began to pray, and as I worked through the Bible, I found that it began to speak to me, that it began to tell me things, that it began to change my desires. One night, Fred and I were sitting in the country club that we had founded. And as I was sitting there, and the friend of mine next to me that was drunk was pawing me all over and trying to get me out into the car. And I was sitting there, and all of a sudden I looked around at my friends, with whom I spent every Saturday evening, and had for years, because we were important in the country club. And I looked around there, and I looked at all these people, and I thought, Florence, what in the world are you doing sitting here? On the way home, I said to my husband, I said, do you know what I was thinking tonight while we were sitting there? He said, don't tell me, I want to tell you first. By this time, he'd been coming to our church, too. He hadn't really committed his life, but he's been coming. And he looked at me and said, I want to tell you what came to me first. I said, what was it? He said, I was sitting there and I was saying to myself, what in the world are we doing, wasting our time in this place? We both had thought of the same thing the same night. When you become a believing Christian, the Lord doesn't give you a list of don'ts. He doesn't say, you may not go to a country club. But, you know, one day you don't want to go to the country club? Or whatever it is that's wrong for you. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the country club. Still sitting there, fine as could be. Got along without me. But at that time, I wouldn't have thought so then. But you see, the Lord will work with us. And it's so gracious of him, the gentle way in which he changes our lives. We don't have to worry that he's going to say, you can never have any fun again. See, I wouldn't like that kind of a religion, would I? But you see, the Lord has told me through many, many experiences that he wants my life to be different. He's told me nicely, politely, and made me think it was my own idea. And through that, he's been able to change me. When the Lord moved my husband and me out here, after he had committed his life to the Lord one Sunday morning in church, when he moved us out here, he gave us a Christian ministry. We'd only been believers a few years, and he put us into a position of leadership, which was really too early, but it's amazing what the Lord can teach you under pressure. And he had us teach a Sunday school class. And when we began to teach a Sunday school class, we really didn't know anything to teach. And so my husband said, could we teach about marriage? Because he said, that's really the thing that the Lord has done in our lives. He's changed our marriage. And he's made us fall in love with each other and care. And they said, as most Sunday school superintendents will say, we don't care what you teach as long as you show up. And so because of that, we therefore wrote a course on Christian marriage. I've just completed putting it into a book, which is called After Every Wedding Comes a Marriage. And we began to write, and we began to speak. And we began to speak from our own experiences, from our own mistakes, and from the answers that God had given us in our own lives. And from that, we began to speak and teach in this particular area. And throughout the last 12 years, we have spent a lot of time counseling with couples and speaking on marriage. My personal ministry has grown so much that it's hardly imaginable to me. I was just thinking as I drove today that, in fact, my daughter said to me last week something about when she was waitressing, that they used to have this expression that last week I didn't know how to spell waitress, and this week I are one. Somehow that went through my mind, and I thought, 12 years ago, you didn't even know what it was to be a Christian, and now you're going to go teach others. It is amazing, really, what the Lord can do in our lives when we're willing. And I was probably the hardest one to get to be willing. So if you're worried about maybe the Lord can't do anything with you, it's amazing what he can do. Because he took Fred and me, two strong-willed, arrogant people, determined to have life our way. And through adverse circumstances that I would never want to go through again, he did break us and mold us and change us. And he made us usable for him today. We did later adopt a young son, and he is now 17 years old. And when he was 11 years old, he looked up at me one day and he said, Mother, I'm so sorry about your sons and what happened to them. But he said, I was just realizing that if it hadn't been for that I wouldn't be your child today. He said, somebody would have had me, and I would have been in some home somewhere because I would have been born anyway. But he said, I wouldn't have been your child, and I might not even be a Christian today. So it does tell us in Romans 8:28 that all things, even though you don't want to go through them again, and I'd never recommend them for anybody else, but that all things, not are good in themselves, but what? All things work together for good. Not to everybody, but to what people? For those who love the Lord and are what? Called according to his purpose. Our family loves the Lord, and he has called us according to his purpose. Let's close in prayer. Our Father, we're so grateful tonight for every lady that's here. And we do know, as was said earlier, that there's no one here except by divine appointment. That you have called each one of us here this weekend. You've called us here for a reason. And dear God, as we are here together tonight, may we open our hearts and open our minds. May we think of the areas that we need change and improvement in. And as we spend this weekend time together, may we, humanly and spiritually, have changes that will send us down the hill in much different shape from what we came. And Lord, I know, as I stand here tonight as a testimony to the fact that you can change a person who is strong-willed and self-centered and manipulative and wanting to control everything in life, that you are able to change that kind of a hard-hearted woman, and you're able to soften the edges, and you're able to give us a spirit of love. And I thank you, Lord, for what you've done in my life, in my husband's life, in the life of all my children. And I thank you, Lord, for what you've done for every lady that's here tonight. I do ask now, Lord, as we close our time tonight and before we go back to our rooms for personal time of prayer and fellowship, that you would deal with our hearts right now And if there is someone here tonight that really has never committed her life to the Lord, who has maybe been a token believer as I was, maybe even the best of token believers, and I was the best. If there's one like that here tonight who doesn't know what it is to have a submitted spirit, who doesn't know what it is to be filled with your power, that she may experience what you want in her life, that she might right now just open her heart and say, as I did that day in that Christian Women's Club in Darien, Connecticut, Lord Jesus, I need you. Come into my life. Change me. Turn me into the kind of person you want me to be. Keep me from being conformed to the world. Transform my mind. Show me what is your will for me. And I thank you ahead of time, Lord, for what you're going to do in my life. And for those of you ladies here tonight, I feel especially that we should pray for those of you who do not have a real love for your husbands. As this verse has come to me tonight in sharing this, I just want to give an opportunity for those of you that, as I was sharing this, it went through your minds, well, I really don't care much for my husband. I hope nobody knows that. I don't really want to even think about it myself, but I really, just soon he leaves. I really don't care. There are things about him that bother me. For those of you that had any thought along that line tonight, might you just ask the Lord to forgive you for that thought? Say, Lord, forgive me. I do really want things my own way. I am a self-centered woman. I haven't been the kind of wife I should be. I ask you, Lord, to take this away. Take away my record of wrongs. And, Lord, cause me to fall in love with my husband. And, Lord, now as we close, I ask that you deal with each one of our hearts tonight, that this time would not be just an amusing story of some other person, not even a heartfelt story of another person, but that tonight would be a life-changing experience for everyone that's here. And that as we pray quietly, that we would know, Lord, that you hear us, because you hear our every prayer, even the hairs on our head are numbered. You know those who are your children. You have put the stamp, seal of the Holy Spirit upon us. And you know those that are yours. And now, Lord, as we close this time, deal with each one of us. Get through to the heart of our problems. And send us home, Lord, on Sunday, new women. Ones who are transformed by the renewing of our minds. And we ask this now in Jesus' precious name. In thanksgiving.